The Guardian.
Children in England are heading back to school, MPs are back in Westminster, and the government hopes workers will return to the office. I'm Jessica Elgott, Deputy Political Editor at The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
What we are doing in this government is getting people back to school, and we are getting people back to work. What he wants to do is extend the furlough.
Children in England return to school this week after what many have dubbed as the summer of chaos. A nerve-wracking and exciting day for so many kids, but those running schools around the country have criticised not getting the financial help or guidance in the run-up to the reopening. So can the embattled Education Secretary Gavin Williamson claw back some trust and clout? Of course, if kids are back in school, parents can head back to the office, right? Well, that's what Boris Johnson is hoping and pushing for, as this week the government launched a media campaign to encourage more employees back to their workplaces. But given many have found a new work-life balance that works for them and their employer, what's really behind this push to the office? A large cohort that is heading back to the workplace this week is British MPs. Later on, we'll hear from a few of them who are questioning how much time they should actually spend in Westminster after living the constituency life for a lot of lockdown. As MPs return, so too do political journalists like me. But when I look around the lobby, the lack of diversity is striking. Later in the show, I speak with Anne Alexander, the senior political producer of Good Morning Britain, about why British democracy needs more black political journalists. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. It's very lovely to be back in front of the mic, although I didn't realise when I left for maternity leave last autumn that the mic would now be in my makeshift office beside the kitchen the next time I presented. But summer recess is over and there is a lot to catch up on. So to help me digest this week in Westminster, I'm joined by my colleague, The Guardian's political correspondent, Peter Walker. Peter, nice to chat to you. So you're in Westminster. It must be quite different since March when most of the lobby would have been working away from Parliament.
It is slightly weird. It still feels very, very strange. It's probably the second or third time I've been in the slightly pokey Westminster office since March. It's definitely the busiest of all the times I've been back, but that's not saying much. Westminster still feels quite empty. You might be able to hear some sounds in the background. There's a helicopter above in the sky because there's Extinction Rebellion protests taking place nearby. And you're going to hear noises and typing in the background because there's been a maximum of four people so far in our office, which is the most there's been for months and months. So it's this strange thing. It's a bit like the Commons Chamber, really. There's some people back, but by no means all the people.
And it's also been a while since we've seen Boris Johnson in action, but Keir Starmer didn't really give him an easy ride in the first PMQs back.
This has been a wasted summer. The government should have spent it preparing for the autumn and winter. Instead, they've lurched from crisis to crisis, U-turn to U-turn. To correct one error, even two might make sense. But when the government's notched up 12 U-turns and rising, the only conclusion is serial incompetence. That serial incompetence is holding Britain back. Will the Prime Minister take responsibility and finally get a grip?
He went straight in on the education chaos over the A-level grading, and we didn't hear many answers back from the Prime Minister on that, did we?
It was slightly strange, even by the standards of recent PMQs. I mean, the exam stuff and all the U-turns over the summer were very much the obvious thing for Starmer to go in on. Things took a slightly unexpected turn because, I mean, Boris Johnson has, even by recent standards, not been very good at answering PMQ's questions. But he actually got reprimanded by the Speaker at one point.
I think there are questions being asked. We do need to try and answer the questions that's being put to the Prime Minister. It will be helpful to those who are watching to know the answers, Prime Minister.
For refusing to answer basically any of the questions, for just talking about something totally different. And there was this particularly angry clash where during one of the attempts to not answer a question, Johnson kind of accused Starmer of complicity in being slightly close to the IRA. And Starmer was clearly furious at that and told, you know, Johnson to take it back, but he kind of didn't. So even by recent standards, he's quite a bad-tempered one.
But the one thing that Boris Johnson seemed to be quite keen to push Starmer on was on school safety. He kept saying that.
I think it would be a fine thing, Mr. Speaker, if today, after 3 months of refusing to do so, as pupils go back to school, if today, finally, he said that school was safe to go back to. Come on.
Keir Starmer.
Starmer's answer was,
I've said it so many times, school is safe. My own children have been in school throughout. There's no issue on this. The Prime Minister's seeking to divide.
Did that catch him off guard? Is it just a case of Boris Johnson not doing any homework before these clashes?
My guess is that the number 10 focus groups or polling seems to think that there is some kind of residual feeling in Britain that perhaps Labour and or the unions are not sufficiently keen to, you know, get pupils back in school. And again, it's just part of this attempt to move the focus away from the Department for Education's, you know, many failings over this. You know, you could say that maybe a few months back, Labour were making a slightly more nuanced point. They're saying, yes, we do want children back at school, but we have to make sure it's safe for children and for teachers. But this is something that Johnson has said as virtually every PMQ since March. But it kind of slightly killed it when Starmer did, as you say, said, yeah, of course schools are safe, my kids have been in school since March. So it'll be interesting to see what Johnson tries next week.
And I guess one of the big places where Johnson really needs there to be grip is on schools reopening, and that's something that he and the Education Secretary Gavin Williamson, a bit often described as the beleaguered Education Secretary Gavin Williamson, they really need to go well, don't they?
They do, and it's quite a tricky one because to a great extent it's a problem where they're going to be heavily judged on it, but they don't have ultimate control over it, in the sense that if this return to workplaces such as it is, coupled with return to schools and students going to university and colleges, you know, the public health experts have been quite clear this will most likely increase the coronavirus spread around the country. You know, less so for primary schools, but possibly for secondary schools. And if there is a kind of, not strictly second wave, but a kind of renewed wave during the autumn and winter and things get very, very bad, then, you know, things have to give. And Johnson and his team face the unpalatable choice of maybe restricting the number of pupils who go to school, which they very much promise they've not done, that they're not going to do, or deciding what else needs to be closed down, you know. And if they decide that, say, pubs and restaurants and cafes need to, you know, be closed down in some areas or restricted even more, then that whole sector is in really, really deep trouble. It's fair to say there's no easy way around it. It's also fair to say that the kind of partly avoidable fuss over the summer over exams hasn't made their reputation for competence over schools any better.
One of the issues where it doesn't really seem that the government is having any impact on public opinion is on the return to work. So they're very keen to get employees back into their offices, especially because of all the economies that depend on people going into city centre offices. And they've also launched their Kickstart programme today with the aim to get under 25s into work. Why aren't they able to convince people to leave their homes and get back on the tube or the train or the bus and head into their offices?
Well, I mean, I guess there's all sorts of reasons. One of the issues, I suppose, is just the fact that, you know, the line is you should go back to your office in a COVID-safe way. But a COVID-safe way means that in many offices, only maybe 30, 40, 50% of all staff can be back. So the idea everyone can go back to work isn't really going to be the case. And there's various reasons. There's, you know, some MPs who haven't returned to Westminster because they're caring for someone who needs to look after themselves or doesn't want to be exposed to the COVID virus. And a lot of people have got kind of caring duties, school too. The government faces this issue that, you know, some kind of experts on this are basically saying the whole high street model, where the economy is based around a lot of people commuting to work, you know, buying a coffee at the station, buying a sandwich when in the office, et cetera, is going to change because people have got used to working away from office for a long time. And even those who do go back might only go in for 2 or 3 days a week. You know, it's a very, very tricky one. You can understand why the government wants this to take place. But again, as with schools, they're fighting factors which they can't really control.
So earlier in the week, the Prime Minister faced questions over his pick for the new cabinet secretary, head of the new civil service, Simon Case. And our colleague Marina Hyde, she tweeted that she was stunned that Johnson's lot embraced yet another opportunity to not appoint a woman, instead going for a guy who's already one of their guys. Do you think she has a point? Is he one of their guys?
To an extent, you could kind of point out the obvious and say no prime minister is going to appoint a cabinet secretary he's not seen as at least partly one of their people, because cabinet secretary is such a crucial job. Case is interesting because he is supposedly the youngest person in the job since it was created, you know, decades and decades back. The interesting thing about it is that he is, despite his relatively young age, he's kind of very experienced, has done a lot of jobs that, you know, he was Prince William's private secretary, and he was very, very deliberately taken from that by Number 10 to kind of look after the government response to COVID in May. But you could almost say that this was a way to get him inside Number 10 and in the frame. I've got to confess, I've never dealt with him in any way, but people who do know him say, you know, he is obviously independent as the civil service is, but is also, they seem to say, perhaps less hidebound, more, you know, open-minded to reform and change than some other people who've been in the job. So it's going to be interesting to see, but, you know, history is littered with prime ministers and presidents who appoint officials or civil servants to kind of senior posts thinking they're going to be a pushover, and they turn out to be something different.
So Johnson's done a U-turn or two or 12 over the past few months, and he's choosing to miss the first meeting, the 1922 committee. He's also choosing to miss out meeting the members of a campaign group representing families bereaved by coronavirus. And there's also all these questions about really how long is he going to stay in the job. But Peter, do you think it's just the way he likes to run things as a chairman rather than a CEO? The CEO is Dominic Cummings.
He's always had an element of that, you know, as London mayor, which was his only real kind of other big executive job. He was a kind of figurehead as much as anything. And to an extent, as London mayor, that's what your job is. You're the kind of symbol of the city. You haven't got a lot of powers. With this, I think both could potentially be true. That is his style. He likes to delegate a lot of things. But, you know, there are a lot of reports and rumours about, for example, that after his very, very serious brush with COVID, if he's ever been the same since, and does he get tired very easily, and, you know, things like that. You know, the thing to bear in mind is that he was only, you know, re-elected as PM about 8 or 9 months back, but a lot of political capital has been burned through during that time. You've had the U-turns over exams, you've had the perception that coronavirus hasn't been handled very well, obviously with a very, very high death toll. You've had the Dominic Cummings stuff. You know, new prime ministers, particularly ones who win a majority of, you know, 80, have got lot of political capital they can play with, but he's going through it quite fast. And there is a sense that, you know, the Tory party is quite a brutal place, as Theresa May found out, that if in 2 or 3 or particularly 4 years' time there's a sense he's not going to win the election when it comes, then he could very much be pushed out. But is he going to jump? You know, my guess would be not.
That was The Guardian's political correspondent Peter Walker. After the break, we'll hear from some of the MPs returning to Westminster this week. And we'll look at why the UK needs more black political journalists. We'll be back after this. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Jessica Elgott. Now, as we mentioned before the break, this week is a big one for people returning after long stints at home, children going back to school in England, the government's hopes of many workers returning to the office, and of course, politicians heading back to Parliament after summer recess. Now, as we saw in PMQs, not everything is back to normal. It's still a hybrid Parliament, with only a percentage of the 650 MPs being allowed into the House of Commons. But nevertheless, many MPs have returned to Westminster. So how do they feel about leaving their constituencies and getting back to the sort of hustle and bustle of the Westminster bubble? We asked three MPs from different parties and different parts of the country that very question.
My name's Clive Lewis. I'm the Labour MP for Norwich South, and I've been the Member of Parliament here for now about 5 years. Basically, working through lockdown has been a bit of a roller coaster. There have been some good days and good weeks, some not so good days and good weeks, and some better ones. But overall, I have enjoyed lockdown. Overall, I would say yes.
I'm Wendy Chamberlain. I'm the Liberal Democrat MP for North East Fife, and I was elected in December 2019 for the first time. So under normal circumstances, though I suppose I've not had very long of normal circumstances, I've been training it to Westminster. So from Fife, that takes about 5 hours with usually a change at Edinburgh Waverley and then on the LNER. One of the challenges for me over the past week is that my son was sent home unwell from school last week, displaying a couple of symptoms that could be COVID related. So we've been self-isolating. Luckily, we've had the results back to say they're negative, but it has definitely caused me a bit of issues looking at alternatives. So I'm actually going to have to fly down tomorrow morning in order to be there for Parliament restarting at 2:30.
I'm Ben Bradley. I'm the Member of Parliament from Mansfield in Nottinghamshire, and I've been the MP since 2017. My own experience has been, whilst some people have totally shut down and been isolating, my own has been kind of carrying on as normal, although I've worked from home. My wife works in a supermarket. So she's a key worker. She's been working every day. My kids have still been at school because she's a key worker. So we've kind of carried on almost normal. Quite often, you spend a lot of time in Westminster, sometimes kind of 4 days a week. My kids are 4 and 6, so that's quite challenging for them and for their mum, obviously, as well. So it's been nice to be at home, to the point where I actually went and spoke to the Chief Whip and said, I quite like this working remotely, and can I do a bit more of it?
One of the things that lockdown has done for me is it's really pushed the constituency to the forefront. Now, people will say, well, that's also really important. Of course it is. But when you spend, half of your week or more in London, in a bubble, a Westminster bubble, it's inevitable that your focus will tend for at least that half of the week to be down there and sometimes beyond it. I felt that there was a much better focus on the constituency, and I don't want to lose that.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, for all of your efforts to ensure Parliament can meet and apply the scrutiny to government that we expect and we embrace.
We had our first period of lockdown of the virtual Parliament. I was working from home and contributing remotely in Parliament like so many others. But actually, because of the restrictions, the lockdown restrictions here in Scotland, it did mean that although I could then travel to London when the virtual Parliament was removed, I still couldn't actually be very visible or active in my constituency. I've certainly had lots of engagement online via Zoom, etc. But that bit of being seen and visible in your constituency has definitely been more challenging.
I've been really active anyway on social media, and I do kind of Facebook Live Q&As and things like that. In the last few weeks, it's been really nice to be able to get back out and start to visit people face to face to some extent. But I always find that the summer recess is a good time to kind of reset. I spend most of the summer trying to get out across the whole constituency with a kind of summer newsletter, delivering those and chatting to people as I go around, just get a sense of the mood and what people are saying, which you can't always do when you're stuck in Westminster 4 days a week. So there's always that benefit. And I think, a lot of MPs, frankly, could do with spending a little bit less time in Westminster and a bit more time in the place they represent.
It is important for votes to be physical because we are coming here together as a single parliament, and we are voting on things that have a major effect on people's lives, every piece of legislation.
Look, Parliament isn't a young institution. The vast majority of the people in there will be 50 plus. And those are people who are at a greater risk of COVID-19. So it doesn't really make a difference. Even with a vaccine, there are going to be people who are going to be nervous about coming down. And it's changed the way that we've done things. There will no longer be packed meetings, for the foreseeable future. I think, that the very notion of the Westminster bubble is now shrunk.
I have known the procedures under COVID for longer than I've known the standard procedures. And although I'd like to think that the fact that we've had to adapt to different ways of working might persist longer term, I think the government would like us to revert to everything going back to the way it was at some point in the future. So I suppose from that perspective, some of the standards, so for example, where you are in relation to where you speak in a debate, etc., I might need to adapt to some of those things. Oh, and bobbing may have to adapt to some of those things.
It's so much more difficult to scrutinise government when there's only, 25 of us allowed in the chamber, and when you haven't got things like Westminster Hall debates and you haven't got that stuff going on in the background where normally you can raise an issue, you can hold a minister to account. We've not had the same kind of face-to-face meetings with ministers that we would normally have on a regular basis. So for everybody, it's much harder. I can understand why government might want to plough on remotely, because they probably have to answer fewer questions than they would normally. But for me, certainly, the chance to be able to raise those issues directly and much more often is something I'm looking forward to.
It'll be good to engage with colleagues, but I suppose, we all have to be very conscious that although levels of COVID have fallen, this virus has not gone away. And so it's really important for us as parliamentarians to ensure that we're adhering to the rules and keeping things as safe as possible, because what we don't want to do is be bringing coronavirus back into our constituencies.
There is more to politics than simply what goes on inside those four walls. There's a whole world out there, which has now become even more accessible now that people have become more attuned to online discussions. So I think there's more potential now for MPs, parliamentarians, to look outside of the bubble, not just inside of it.
That was Labour's Clive Lewis, the Conservatives' Ben Bradley, and Wendy Chamberlain of the Liberal Democrats. Now, early on as the coronavirus spread across the UK, we learned that people from Black, Asian and ethnic minority communities were worst affected by the pandemic. They are more likely to die from the virus than white people and more likely to suffer economically. However, when many of us tuned in to the daily government coronavirus briefings, we rarely saw a journalist asking questions of the government who wasn't white. One of the reasons is that there are simply not many people of colour in UK political journalism. The Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism, Journalists in the UK report from 2016, stated that Black Britons make up approximately 3% of the British population, but just 0.2% of journalists. I read this statistic in a piece written by Anne Alexander for the online publication Each Other. Anne is a senior political reporter for ITV's Good Morning Britain, and I wanted to talk to her about that piece she wrote. But I started off by asking her to tell me about her journey into the lobby.
I was based in the Midlands working for the Express and Star, a group of regional newspapers. And at the time, the regional lobby was really, really big. And there were two people working for the Express and Star who were based down at Parliament. And so they needed a person to cover. And instead of advertising the job, they gave it to someone who was freelancing in London. So me being a little bit of a shop steward was a bit furious and said, well, look, you know, there are other people who work for this company who may have wanted a chance to do this incredible job. So I kind of, you know, stood up for the workers and so on. But it was too late. They'd already given the job to, you know, this very, very capable young woman. And then about two or three weeks to go before she was meant to start the job, she got offered a different job. So she let them down at the last minute. And so my editor said, oh, you big mouth, you were the one complaining. Can you go to London and cover and work in the lobby for us for a few months until we work out what we're going to do? So I initially moved to London for sort of 3 months. And 18 years on, I haven't actually left. So it was a complete and utter accident. And when I actually came to work in the lobby, I had no idea how it worked. It was a completely whole new world for me. So it was a real eye-opener moving from West Bromwich to London and working in Westminster. It was just like something out of, you know, a film or something. I was completely, my mind was blown.
You wrote a piece for the human rights platform, Each Other, at the end of August. And the headline was Why Our Democracy Needs More Black Political Journalists. So what inspired you to write it right now at this moment?
Well, it's something which has been on my mind for a long time. I mean, if I go back to 2011, I actually wrote a similar piece. At the time, there was a growing number of women in the lobby, which, you know, had transformed the lobby somewhat over sort of the previous 7 years from when I'd first started. So I'd actually spoken about this a long time ago, sort of like 8-9 years ago. And then with the whole Black Lives Matter movement, and lots of discussion about representation, I was talking to somebody that I know, and I just thought it was something that needed to be talked about. So, you know, I wrote this piece and I didn't expect it to have quite the impact that it did. I mean, for me, I was just writing a piece which just was very, very reasonable and just something which most reasonable people would agree with, but I was quite surprised by how surprised other people were at the lack of representation, you know, in political journalism and specifically in a little group called The Lobby.
And you start the piece, for those who haven't read it, by talking about a male MP mistaking you for a waitress at a Westminster reception, and you'd only been a political reporter for a few months at that point. And How did you respond to that? You write it in a sort of very calm, measured way, but sure, it must have been awful.
Interestingly, when I was handed the glass, I was so stunned, I actually took it. That's what's really ridiculous. I just took the glass because I didn't know what else to do. And then I turned and I found an actual waitress and put it on her tray. And to be honest, I mean, I use that as an example of just one of the things that has happened to me. But I wasn't, at the time, I wasn't really, really upset. And looking back, it's not that I feel upset about it. It's just what I'm used to. And to be honest, I mean, that was nothing compared to some of the things that I have been through in terms of racism and sexism, because I suspect that some of the time it's a combination of the two. if I go back to growing up as a child in the 70s and 80s, when things were very, very, very different, name calling, like the N word and the P word, because this is the levels of stupidity we were dealing with. When we were children, it was completely normalized because that's how things were. And we just got used to it. When I look back at that, it really, really upsets me because I was a child. I'm much more better equipped to deal with the more subtle forms of racism that, you know, I will face, not on a day-to-day basis necessarily now, but you can see them. And because I'm an adult now, I've learned how to deal with them. So, yeah, I did write it in a very matter-of-fact way because for me, it's not massively emotional. It's just how it is. And I have my ways of dealing with it because I've had to learn how to deal with it.
You mentioned, obviously, this was when you've been in the lobby a long time now, and that kind of behaviour, though, is still quite prevalent around Westminster. We hear black MPs talk about it, MPs like Diane Abbott, some of the other new MPs who say they're recently mistaken for each other, or they're told they can't get in certain lifts. And that still seems to be a story that we hear kind of every 6 months happening, and probably more stuff that we don't hear about.
No, absolutely. I mean, it does happen. I mean, I, in the last sort of 2 years, have been mistaken twice for a black female MP. One of them, Marsha de Cordova. The other one, Dawn Butler. And in fact, the Dawn Butler one was interesting because I remember one of her colleagues saw me in the corridor, held up her hand and said, "Hey, sister," and held her hand up. And I just looked and I just left her hand just hanging there. And then after about 3 or 4 seconds, she was like, "Oh, sorry." So yes, there is still this issue of being mistaken. And, you know, I laugh about it because it's just something which happens. It's not that it's funny. It's just that's something that you just have to put up with. It's the way Westminster is. I mean, it is still predominantly middle class, still predominantly white and male. That is how it is. And I think some of the people who operate in Westminster, not all, but some, have very, very narrow experiences. I think that is definitely changing. It's definitely, definitely changing. I mean, if I look, when I came into the lobby in 2002, if I look at the makeup of the lobby, for example, you know, it has progressed. You know, there are definitely more working class people. There are definitely more women. And in fact, there are more women in senior roles, which is really good to see, as in political editors, like, for example, at The Guardian and at The Mirror. What's interesting, though, is that even though there are more women and there are more working class, there aren't more black and brown journalists working in the lobby. That's the one thing which just seemed to have stood still, and there hasn't been an awful lot of progress.
You're still the only black female lobby journalist, which is just an extraordinary fact. And I mean, it's hard to say, but what has stopped UK political journalism becoming more diverse?
It is, isn't it? And in fact, I do have some breaking news because yesterday, I heard that there's a young lady called Jasmine, who I think is just joining the lobby for the FT, and she's a young black female journalist. So actually, there might now be two black women in the lobby as of yesterday.
Well, that would be fantastic.
Yeah, so there hasn't been really much progress in terms of black and sort of Asian and other minorities working in the lobby. And I wonder whether this is partly to do with the fact that it is so hard to get into the lobby. You know how it is. You have to train as a journalist, get a job as a journalist, then work your way up because, you know, the job as a lobby journalist is seen as a really senior job. So there are only a handful of opportunities because once you join the lobby, you'll know this. You tend not to leave because it's an amazing job and it's an amazing place to work. So there are limited opportunities. So I think it takes you a long time to get to the point where you might be able to get into the lobby, and then you face the block of actually getting a job. Also, I mean, I look at the route that I did to get into journalism. I mean, I came through regional newspapers and I got into the lobby through the regional lobby, which when I joined was a huge force. I'm trying to think, there might have been about 20 regional lobby journalists when I first joined in 2002. the regional lobby has sadly contracted, as regional newspapers have contracted in the last 20 years. So I think some of those roots which may have allowed, you know, people from working class backgrounds, people, you know, who are black, they may have been cut off. So I think it's possibly even harder now, you know, you almost certainly need to have a degree plus some sort of postgraduate qualification to get into journalism. Gone are the days, you know, when people like, you know, the great and late Chris Moncrief, you know, went in, you know, as a teenager and just learned his craft, you know, just on the job. So I think there are barriers to becoming a journalist in the first place. But I think, you know, there are lots of people that I know who have wanted to get into the lobby but have struggled just because there aren't that many opportunities.
It's not just obviously about how the lobby looks to the outside world, which is bad enough, but it's also about what we cover. And you write about, you know, the coronavirus daily press briefings and seeing just how many white journalists were asking questions, and particularly when there was this story about how there was a sort of significant difference in the number of black and Asian and minority ethnic deaths of coronavirus, and a story which, you know, gained traction eventually, but might have potentially become a bigger story faster if we'd have had a more diverse lobby.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, journalists who are non-white will only sort of focus on non-white stories and stories which bother them. But it was really, really obvious to me very, very early on that all the pictures we were seeing of these people dying who worked for the NHS were not white. They were either Asian or black. So I kind of noticed that really early on. Then other journalists started writing about it. And I think it took a little while for that to gain some traction. I mean, obviously later on, everyone was totally across it. But I think there are things that you will see which are different if your experience is different to, you know, another journalist. I see things differently. And in lots of ways, I'm very, very sensitive to things which impact race, because it's me. We all know that news is subjective. The way that we deal with it is completely subjective. It should be objective, but it's not. It's completely coloured by who you are. So I think that does have an impact. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, I'm not going to cover the same stories as my white colleagues. Of course I am. But there are going to be certain issues which strike me more, possibly, than someone else who is from a different background.
You write towards the end of your piece that in a true democracy, all parts of society should have a voice, and political journalism is a crucial part of that democratic process. Do you think we're failing that democratic process so far?
I think we probably are. I mean, I'm really, really proud to work in the lobby. Now, you know, I work with lots of extremely clever and really, really lovely people. But I do think that, you know, we need to reflect all of society as far as we possibly can. At the moment, we're just not doing that. I mean, one of the things which I didn't really go into, but I mean, look at disability, for example. I mean, I don't know anybody in the lobby who is disabled, or maybe I'm doing a disservice here because obviously some disabilities can be hidden. But I do think that at a time like this, when we are literally talking about life and death when it comes to coronavirus, when we're heading towards Brexit, which is going to have a massive, massive upheaval on the whole of our country, I do think it's imperative that we make sure that everybody is involved in this key part of the democratic process, especially when we are 4 years away from the next general election, most likely. So journalists play a really, really important part in that. And I do think that we probably need to make more of an effort to make sure that new voices, different voices who have different perspectives, are involved.
Anne Alexander, Senior Political Reporter for Good Morning Britain, thanks for speaking with me.
You're welcome.
We'll include a link to Anne's article on today's episode description on the Guardian website. Now, this week marks exactly 3 months until the US presidential election, with one of the most divisive campaigns between Republicans and Democrats already underway. So we thought it would be a good time to launch a Politics Weekly Extra, which will focus solely on what's happening in America. Every Friday, Guardian columnist Jonathan Friedland will be catching up with one of our reporters for a breakdown of the latest election news. This week, Jonathan will be joined by The Guardian's political correspondent in the US, Lauren Gambino. The pair will take a deep dive into Donald Trump's presidency and beyond, as they ask the question, is Trump a conspiracy theorist? Make sure to listen into that and just look for it in our usual Politics Weekly feed. But for now, I want to thank our guests, Peter Walker, Anne Alexander, Ben Bradley, Wendy Chamberlain and Clive Lewis. The producer is Danielle Stevens. I'm Jessica Elgott. Please look after yourselves and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.